Welcome to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast, a podcast bringing you news and views about sustainable agriculture from across the southeastern United States. Every show will feature insightful interviews and deep dives into sustainable agriculture topics with farmers, ranchers, land-grant universities, and local food system advocates. Now, here's your host, Brennan Washington.
Welcome to another edition of the Sustainable Ag Writer. I'm your host, Brennan Washington. And today we're going to be having a conversation with Rashid Nouri about urban agriculture. Urban ag is something that's been close to my heart for quite some time. Our farm is technically considered an urban ag operation. And for many, many years, urban ag did not really get its due when it came to being recognized as a legitimate agricultural production system. A lot has changed in urban ag, and there's now a lot of great farmers who are farming in urban situations. I think of Patchwork City Farms here in Atlanta, Malik Yakini's operation up in Detroit, Michigan, of course, our farm, and Truly Living Well, which was founded and run by our guest today, Rashid Nouri. During this pandemic, urban ag has really stepped to the forefront as a way of getting people fresh food and fresh vegetables. Most urban ag operations are noticing increases in sales and increased demand from consumers. So we want to take today to really dive into urban ag. What are the challenges and opportunities? And I hope you enjoy the show. Take care and stay tuned for my interview with Rashid Nouri. Okay, welcome back to another edition of the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast. And today I have the distinct honor of having on one of the founding fathers of urban agriculture, not only in the South, but in the entire nature, Brother Rashid Nouri. Welcome, Rashid.
Greetings, brother. How you doing?
Not too bad. You know, I had to say one of the founding fathers because Bobby Wilson may hear this and give me a hard time. Yeah.
Bobby's been doing this a long time,
yeah.
But I think, with all due respect to all the folks who have contributed to this movement, yeah, I did get started about 50 years ago. So
yeah. So I like to start our interview out before we delve into the many topics I want to talk to you about. I don't know if you had a chance to watch that CNN special the other night. I think it was Kamau Bell on farmers. Yeah, and I want to start the conversation there because there's some distinct things I noticed, and I wanted to get your opinion on it because I think it'll lead us into, you know, a deeper discussion of the role of urban ag. But there was a couple things I noticed. So I knew Tammy. I'm sure you know Tammy Gray Steele, and I know John Boyd and his work with the National Black Farmers Association. What was interesting to me is that urban ag was not represented at all in that program, and not only that, the highlight of the program was pointing out many of the historical issues we have with commodity-based farming, and which has been a bear for our Black farmers. So I just want to get your opinion about this continued lack of inclusion in the discussion around agriculture of urban ag and what you thought of that program.
Well, I'd actually see the program, but I know the people.
Oh, okay.
I was one of those who welcomed John Boyd and his mules and wagon to the Department of Agriculture back in the Clinton administration. So we go back, and the people I was working with helped him get one of his first major interviews on CNN. Mm-hmm. In the 90s. So I know him and his work. That having been said, urban agriculture does not have the status, that I think is required. My work these last few years has focused on urban agriculture. 82% of Americans live in urban areas, and humankind used to live within walking distance of where their food is produced. That still is what's real around most of the world. And I think we need to go back to that. That's why these farmers markets are so important. So with that having been said, with we need to focus on the small farms and urban agriculture. The contradictions of big ag, commercial, capitalist agriculture have really shown up during this pandemic. You looked at TV a couple of months ago, you saw farmers, big farmers, plowing food into the ground. That made no sense to me. And this spring has been one of the most lucrative for the small farmers and urban agriculturists. The demand is so high. I think this the pandemic, is heightened the contradictions, and people have become more aware and cognizant of the importance of the food. It's been raised. Then they have lines at the store so they can go in and get their what folks needed. I think it's absurd that people are fighting over toilet paper. That don't make any sense to me. most of the world just washes their behinds after they use the facilities, but not in this country. And you know, you got lines at the farm supply stores or departments at Lowe's and Home Depot. And over the last couple of years, the Trump administration has given at least $75 billion to support Big Ag. And they just came out 3 weeks ago. You're more familiar with this than me. But a month ago, they said they want to put $3 million into urban ag. So no, that's out of balance. I have a number of things on my desk trying to raise the profile of the urban agriculture and demonstrate the importance. We just here in our metropolitan area over the last 15 years, we see how things have already begun to change. These young people are growing food everywhere. This is farmers markets. When I came to Atlanta, you're hard pressed to find any farmers markets. Now you can find one somewhere every day. They're selling food in front of the train stations. People are delivering it food to folks in the community. So we've come a long way. And if you compare that, I've had people tell me I'm crazy for some of the things I'm saying now, but it's the same thing I said 50 years ago. So you can imagine how they thought back then. We're talking about organic agriculture, urban agriculture. Well, it was not seen as important, but I think the significance is becoming more recognized. It is more recognized and appreciated than it was in the past. We have a long way to go. It needs to be scaled up. And one of the things that I try to point out, not too long ago, we called it a local food movement. And I think the paradigm has now shifted. We have created local food economies, and it's just a question of how quickly we can scale it and get more and more people involved.
Yeah, that's a great point, Rashid, because, you know, I had Scott Marlowe Rafi on the show, I think my second or third episode, and we talked. One of the things we talked, and I think this is before the pandemic, we've had some conversations then, but I agree with you that there has been some good things coming out of this crisis for small-scale farmers and for urban agriculture. And the question for a lot of us who do this work now is how do we make those permanent and not backslide into the status quo once we get this thing under control? And the thing that keeps coming up to me in the work that I do across the Southeast is that we need to start looking at more regional type solutions, you know, scale these smaller local economies into more of a regional, especially when it comes to supply chain type issue. Yeah. And I really, my one disappointment with urban ag has always been, we still seem to have a disconnect with our fellow farmers in a rural area. A lot of it is not it's just due to systemic problems we have in some of our rural communities. But, you know, we have a lot of Black farmers in these rural areas who should be able to benefit and work with our farmers in the urban area. One of the things I'm starting to coin is, you had mentioned the money that's being pushed out to these large corporate farms. And one of the things I'm hearing, and I'm sure you're hearing it too, is there seems to be a new type of redlining going on. And I'm calling it technological redlining. So in order to apply for this money, you have to have the internet. You have to be competent in knowing how to attend a webinar in order to understand this stuff. We have a distinct advantage in urban areas that we have access to broadband. But do you see the same issues that many of our Black farmers in rural areas in terms of access to, say, pandemic emergency funds, some of these USDA type programs? Do those barriers exist for our urban farmers, even though we have things such as decent access to broadband and stuff?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Because, you know, urban farmers have less respect than the rural farmers. okay? Mm-hmm. Particularly black urban rural farmers. People have yet to, the broad community is yet to recognize the significance and importance of the urban agriculture. This pandemic has helped people to see the significance more so, but we have a tremendously long way to go before people think that small farms and urban agriculture can viable alongside these big commercial farms. You know, there have been so many studies done to show that organic agriculture is just as productive, it's less costly as the big ag, and we have to get there, and it's going to take some time. I think that I have a 4-point program. I guess I can call it a program. I think first thing in order to expand the small farms and urban agriculture, first thing that's necessary is commitment to come. We need to have a recognition, an acknowledgement of the importance of by the municipalities. You know, because you think global and act local. Atlanta was the first city to have an urban ag director. That was a big deal. Now there are at least two more in the country. There's Boston and D.C. But that acknowledgement comes first, and then we deal with the input, land, labor, and the capital to be able to put these things together. So those resources needed, I would like to see them committed to the urban agriculture. So there's still a lot of the work you've been doing, brother, is just so important. And you do, it makes perfect sense that you thinking regionally, which is important. And that's the work you've been doing across the whole Southeast, connecting people, helping people. Your question, if I understood it correctly, is are the urban farmers and the small farmers finding the same kind of barriers? Absolutely, because that money has not been set aside for them. And it's been set aside to support corporate agriculture. And it makes it very difficult to get there. So, you know, organizations like the Food Well Alliance, SARE, are you able to give small amounts of money to people to get things done? But this is big money. You know, what is $75 billion? 5% of that is almost $5 billion. You know, if you can have that much money, no, that arithmetic was wrong. But there's nobody talking about putting billions into urban agriculture or to support small farms. And I mean, there's just so many ways that can be done. The metropolitan region here in Atlanta is the greenest city in America by virtue of trees and open space. Now, let me define just a little bit about small farms and urban agriculture. We cannot grow grains, wheat, mm-hmm. oats mm-hmm. in urban areas. You're not going to raise cattle in urban areas. That has to be done in the rural. But with all the land that's available here, we can grow all the fruits and vegetables to feed everybody in the metropolitan area if there was a will. And that's where the commitment comes in, because the land is there. We need to work on the labor some more. And that's begun because we're training these children, all the farm to school programs that exist now, the training programs like what Truly Living Well has done, teaching people how to grow. Because folk are interested. Man, it's just, the internet is just this steaming with people interested in learning more and more about agriculture, what to do, how to grow it. You know, I got a book that's been out about a year now, and I tell people,
growing out loud, right?
Say it again.
Growing out loud.
Growing out loud. I tell people, if you want to know how to grow tomatoes, my book is not the one to buy. Mm-hmm. Okay, but if you want to learn about how the food systems work, how it's connected, where the bottlenecks are. You know, I discuss all the things, some of the history, explaining how we gotten into this situation. And we have to train the children. We need the education. We need to have training programs in the high school and technical schools. Partnerships need to be developed with ag educators. The work that you're doing it. Your work is providing financial support, capital. You are doing training. You and helping to get acknowledgement and commitment to this work, and I commend you for that. I salute you for what you're doing.
You know, you helped pave the way for me, because I really wasn't looking to do a lot of advocacy work. And when you made your pitch to get more people of color on the Georgia Organics board, and Alice Rose approached me, that was a direct result of the work that you did. So I want to say thank you. But I want to go back to what you just said about funding and how it's just a pittance in the funding. And I know combined, and that's something I try and keep my eye on, at least from the USDA standpoint, because SARE money goes to a lot of initiatives that you and I care about, 2501 goes. And I think combined this year, I want to say those two programs together nationally, their total outlay of funds is probably going to be around $40 or $45 million, which is nothing compared to, just look at what they're pushing out the door to these farmers in the pandemic, you know.
And that's not urban farmers. That's not small farmers. That's the big A.
Yeah, yeah, it certainly is. So, Rashid, you've walked a very, very long path in this work. And so can you tell people a little bit about your history before you started getting focused on urban ag? Because it is a rich history. So,
well, thank you, brother.
I know we only got an hour, hour and a half. So, you know.
Here's the joke about that is the very first professional job I had out of university was doing the same thing I did with Built with Truly Living Wild. Urban farms, working with the children in school. But then from there, I progressed. You know, I started in this business. God told me what to do, and it was to learn everything about agriculture from food to the table and to do it experientially. And in writing my book, as I was looking back at my history, I realized that the first, because I'm a city boy. Let me start there. I'm not a country boy. I don't have family that's, my mother's a pure Yankee, and my father's a Jamaican in New York. So I don't have that. So this is my path has been, it was God told me what to do. That's bottom line on that. But the first, as I go back and look at it, the very first thing that I had any connection with food was when I ran for student body president back in 1965. And one of the things that I wanted to do was have my platform was to install a fresh fruit and juice machine on campus put next to the sodas and the candy.
Okay, what university was this?
That was in high school.
High school.
Mm. Yeah, high school. Then, you know, going to college, I was interested in the men and women who created the post-colonial world. So that's what I studied. And I realized, and being a child of the 60s, we were talking about nation building, Black power. In order to build a nation, you have to be able to feed, clothe, and shelter your people. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to decide if I wanted to be a carpenter to build or a printer to distribute information. And that's when I got my message to learn everything about food. So I went to grad school and got a degree in plant and soil science. And then quickly proceeded to unlearn. I didn't know anything. I didn't, you know, parts of the plant, different types of soil and that kind of stuff. So then I had to unlearn a lot of things that they were teaching because I knew I was interested in organic agriculture. And proceeded from there. After I worked for the Extension Service as an assistant extension agent, because they would laugh at me when I talked about urban ag back in the early 70s. And they said it's not commercially viable, it would never happen. And I can understand why people would think that way. They were hooked on the chemicals. I was in San Diego, University of California, Davis is one of the most world's renowned ag school. But what they were doing is teaching people chemistry. Everything was grown with chemicals. And from there, I belonged to the Nation of Islam, and I was asked to come, after Mr. Muhammad died, to come down south. It was my first time coming to south, and that was 1975. And I ran the nation's farm. We had 13,000 acres of land. Wow. We had three farms, two in Alabama, one here, one in South Georgia. And I lived on the South Georgia farm, which was just absolutely beautiful. We had cattle, dairy cows, sheep, chicken farm, lived underneath the pecan grove, oak trees. It was just idyllic. I didn't have to teach my children anything about the birds and the bees because the animals were all there and they could see how they did. I built up from there, went over to Louisiana and built two things I did over there. I worked for Father McKnight at the Southern Cooperative Development Fund. And I worked at a similar job to yours, working with co-ops throughout the eight Southern states. And with the Black farmers, helping them learn to do their books and work cooperatively to market their crops. And then I built a farm up in Ville Platte, St. Landry Parish, St. Landry Agricultural Development Corporation. It was a training facility when we grew food there, working with the small farmers. Soon after that, I ran a rose garden. We had 30,000 rose bushes. Yeah, that was really amazing. I was up in Minnesota. And then I went to work for Cargill. With Cargill, I operated the, managing a soybean processing plant. And we were doing 50,000 bushels a day of soybeans. From there, I told them, I'd been in economic analysis in the company, then came to Georgia. Then I wanted to go to Africa, but they first sent me out to Asia, and I spent 3 years in Asia working in all the non-communist nations, feed, seed, poultry, with all the businesses looking for. I was an investment manager looking for opportunities to expand the company. When I left there, I came back to the States. I was in work for Clinton's administration, the Department of Agriculture with Mike Espy, who is now running for Senate. He was the first and only Black Secretary of Agriculture. He was very young. He was 39 years old when he got that job. Then I spent time working with Ron. Espy got kicked out. Ron Brown, I went over to Commerce. And because of what I was doing at the Department of Agriculture, there were a number of things. We helped change change the county committee system that made it more accessible. Still tremendous problems. Don't misunderstand. But we made it. I'm losing my terminology. There's a committee in every county that runs and decides how the USDA money is going to be spent. And we open access on that. And I also commissioned the Miller Report, which proved the disparate treatment that the Department of Agriculture gave to Black farmers throughout the South. And it was a predecessor to the Pigford suit. A lot of the information that came to Pigford was based upon that report. The Miller Report was buried so far deep in the Department of Agriculture, if you called up there now and tried to get it, you'd have difficulty because they didn't want that. What it said was the United States Department of Agriculture, whose job is to support agriculture, is discriminating against the farmers, and they didn't want to have that out. Did some urban ag back in California. Then I went to Ghana. That was interesting, but I left out a major portion. I greenfielded in Nigeria back in the late 80s. We traded cotton, they had 13 cotton gins, cotton, maize, sorghum, cocoa, rubber, sugar, traded all those commodities there. What I wanted to do was get into added value processing, but the folks who, Cargill managers, weren't prepared. They were scared of dealing with all those the Black folk over in there. those are the original Negroes from Nigeria.
So how'd you end up in Atlanta?
When I was in Ghana, I went over there and represented a local man to buy the Ghana Cotton Company. They had which had a 70% market share. And the way that cotton has grown in Africa is pretty much sharecropping is how it's done. That deal didn't happen, and I was trying to decide what to do. Met three ladies in the place where I used to hang out, jazz club I used to hang out in, and they said they wanted to be gentle lady farmers and asking my advice. I said, well, whoa, help make a lot of people make money, get rich. Let me tell them what I wanted to do. And so it was sitting there where that the concept of truly living well came to mind. And I came from Ghana to Atlanta to build what became Truly Living Well Center for Natural Urban Agriculture.
Okay. So talk a little bit about Truly Living Well. If you're anywhere in Atlanta, definitely, and in Georgia, but in many places throughout the South, many people know the name and respect the name Truly Living Well. So tell us a little bit about it.
Yes, sir. It was interesting. It's been an interesting experience. Truly Living Well, the Training and Education Center. Three principles: grow food, grow people, grow community. And growing food, we were doing tens of thousands. Let me clarify. I stepped down as a CEO a couple of years ago, okay? But I'm still the founder. So sometimes I talk in the present when I'm actually not there anymore.
Yeah. That was supposed to be your retirement, man.
Well, see, I explained that. Yeah, they gave me a wonderful birthday party, and I'm not retired. That's one R word I don't like. The one I do like is reparations. Retirement, I'm not retired. I'm just not running the organization anymore. Right. So, Truly Live Well, grow food, people, and community. We train so many people, and a good number of people who are involved in urban agriculture in this community, expanded community, have come through Truly Living Well one way or another, been connected with it. And that's, and it's so wonderful now to see all these young people getting involved and doing the work. And from my perspective, it's time for their young people to do things. I know the people whose shoulders I'm standing on, and I talk about that in the book, and it's given me the vision to do the work that I have done. So if these young folk can stand on what us older folks, veterans, like Bobby Wilson and myself, I mean, they can see even when it's their turn to do it. You get to a certain age, man, when that, if people don't understand, that farming is no joke. It's hard work.
So I still got my place, and yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's hard work. Yeah. So it's I think it's so important. It's why the education is important. Get those young, the children involved in it. And we can help build farmers, because the farmers, well, average age of farmers, 60 plus these days. And black people have been losing land, giving up their farmland. But we can grab those children and get them interested and plant seeds in them so that they see the importance of agriculture, continue to teach it, demonstrate it. So rather than folk running away from the land, I'm seeing them running to the land now. And that's tremendous progress as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. I do want to add, I've seen the growth and just the work that you've done through organizations who are now coming to the forefront. And one of my favorite is Habesha Works.
Oh, that there's a young man named Kashawn Myers who built Habesha, helping Africa, AJ, build.
Yeah, I got it on the back of my show. Helping Africa Culture by Education, and I don't remember. I know Habesha.
He's Kashawn has a training program. He is very specific that he's training black people. Mm-hmm. Truly Living Well was more ecumenical. You know, I didn't mind who, anybody was interested, we would serve, but my personal interest was black folks and building in the black community. I just didn't exclude anybody else. But Habesha is a wonderful program. We've collaborated on another level, of many levels, and now that I'm not running the farm, we have been able to collaborate. I've been able to help him as best I can.
Let me tell you why I love them. And my work, you know, I work behind the scenes. You don't see me out front a lot. And mainly it's trying to help our farmers, both urban and rural, understand where this funding stream's at and help them apply and get that money, you know? Because for too many years, as you well know, for too many years, nobody was there to do that, or very few people was there to do that. And I always tell people, look, you work with me. I can't guarantee you're going to get funding, but you're going to stand a hell of a lot better chance. And it's always disappointing to me, Rashid, to sit and say a SARE review panel and look at the list of grantees who weren't getting funded, and I may know five or six of them, and they didn't pick up the phone and say, hey, I'm about to apply for the grants. Habesha did that. And so they got the first 2 years of our inaugural education grant, they got it. They got a $50,000 grant, and they have parlayed that. I can't say the name of the grant program, but they just got awarded a large training program from one of the national USDA programs. Yeah. And they always reference the work that they did with Truly Living Well. So you should be proud of that. You should be proud of that acorn, man.
Wow, thank you. I didn't know that's true. One of the things that people have said about me, which I feel is quite true, is I have no fear of speaking truth to power. Mm-hmm. And I'll call a spade a spade. Over my tenure, from starting in a backyard down in Riverdale, we generated over $6 million. Mm-hmm. And in the urban ag field, that's pretty substantial.
Yeah.
You know, it's a pittance compared to big ag, but mm-hmm. we were able to do that. And twice we built the largest farms in Atlanta. We built that one downtown in the old 4th Ward, which you can see from the freeway. Paid way too much money to be there, but
was that a $50,000? I think you said, or was that Wheat Street?
No, Wheat Street. Uh-huh. Yeah, I was paying just to use that land. I was paying $50,000 a year, and that's absurd. Okay, yeah. But what it did, you could stand. It was in the shadow of the downtown skyscrapers. People could see it from the freeway, and it demonstrated the efficacy, proved the concept of urban agriculture. Because it was people could come and see it. They chased us out of there. It took about a year for us to move because I literally took all the dirt, all the soil, and 125 fruit trees and moved them from there to the new site over in Westview, Ashview Heights, which is in West End.
What was that, about 3 or 4 years ago? I remember when that happened.
We started moving in 2015. Okay. Yeah. So the significance is, one, it's bigger. Two, True Living Well owns the land.
Yep.
And that, I think, is significant, that so many of these farmers that don't own their land. And that's a problem. All wealth, all health, all life begins and ends with the soil. And if someone else can come in and take it from you, that's a problem. Or tell you, okay, that's enough, you got to move. I can give you a whole bunch of stories about that. Because the system that we live in, American business, it's difficult. Many places, perhaps even most places in the world, be careful with that, not overexpand, but you don't necessarily own the land. What's yours is what you produce from it. The land is communal land. I mean, Native Americans felt that way. How can you say you own this land? You know, you can have what you produce from it, but the land belongs to God, and we're only using it as a borrowing it from our children, because we have to leave something for the children. So the fact that in this country, that's what land ownership is what's necessary. I'm very happy that we're able to leave True Living Well with us.
Yes, land ownership seems to be a particular problem for urban ag areas because A, the cost of the land, and B, a lot of political, farming is just not seen, as you stated earlier, as something that's part of the cityscape. And, you know, when the movers and shakers of cities look at land, they see condos, they see mixed-use development properties. It's very hard for them to see green spaces and farms and across the land. So how do you think, you and I talked, I think when I saw you at the National Good Food Networks conference, that's the last conference I was at because they ended it. I don't know if you were there when they ended it like that Friday morning because of the pandemic. That was the last conference I was at. But you had stated that you have this vision for an urban ag program. You want to talk about that a little bit? About,
New Orleans, That was a marker for me, too. Yeah. It was so interesting to see how people kept leaving, they getting more and more scared. And it was ironic for me, I wasn't feeling well that week. I never left the hotel. Here I am in New Orleans, around the corner from all this great food, and I ended up staying at a hospital eating some fake New Orleans food. It was terrible. Oh, wow. And then I had some
hospital or hotel.
Say it again.
Were you in a hospital or a hotel?
No, in the hotel.
Oh, okay.
The food that hotel where it was held, that food was terrible, man.
Yeah.
And I stayed at the hotel the whole time. I never left it. I wasn't feeling real good.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, the program, I don't know if I presented it as a program, but I do have a some specific ideas of what needs to be done. One was a new homestead act. Okay, there are four things that happened within 48 days in 1862, which is established the United States as the richest, established United States to become the richest agricultural producing nation in the entire history of mankind. That's what's amazing to me. First was the Department of Agriculture was established, and that was the first subject matter department in U.S. government. What do I mean by that? Today, you got health, you got labor, you got energy, you got transportation, all these different departments of government. But the Department of Agriculture was established. Then the Homestead Act, where they paid for white folks to come to the United States, gave them money and gave them land to grow, particularly up in the Midwest. It also displaced the Native Americans. It contributed to the genocide that was committed against the Native American people. But from a United States perspective, it was very important because they got people to come out there and supported them, put money into it. Then there was the Land Grant College, the Morrill Act, which has had many iterations. The first one was, what people don't understand is that Big Ag does no research whatsoever, none. All of that is paid for by the taxpayers. When I got into this business, it took about 12 to 14 weeks to grow a broiler. Now they do it in six. And it wasn't companies like Purdue or Tyson that did that research. It was done at the universities. Okay. Here in Georgia, you got Fort Valley and the University of Georgia. And so all these chicken farmers just go right down to the university and tell them, this is what you need to do to make your crops grow. And the taxpayers pay for that. Then there was the Railroad Act, which brought equipment from the East out to the Midwest and down to the South. Midwest, primarily. There was a big fiasco because those railroad companies were just stealing money left and right. They got land grants on both sides where the tracks were, plus the money. All they had to do is send a bill to Congress, and Congress paid them for it. So it's the establishment of the Department of Agriculture, the Homestead Act, the Morrill Act for the universities, and the Railroad Act are the four things that happened within 48 days. Okay, Lincoln signed off on those. And I think we need to have a similar kinds of support for small farms and urban agriculture is what I would like to see done. Of that $75 billion that Trump has put out, just get a portion of it to go to support small farms and urban agriculture. And I think that the path that needs to be followed is first getting the commitment. This pandemic has stopped some of my efforts. One of the committees that I'm on, we're going to have Fulton County Commission endorse urban agriculture, but the focus, we had the progress on that, but the focus turned to the pandemic, health concerns for the people. So it made it very difficult to continue a conversation about the food in the midst of a pandemic. But if you really understand what's going on, there should be a greater emphasis on the food, not a turning your back on it. It's because people don't understand the education process. Then there are three things that you need to build a nation: land, labor, and capital. Okay. And I think that's what needs to be committed to the urban ag, small farms and urban agriculture to bring it up. So that's the program in summary that I would like to see happen.
Okay. Yeah. That's basically where you explained it to me in New Orleans. So with that, I want to pivot. So I was like you, I used to go into USDA meetings and urban ag, you were pretty much a joke of people turning nose up at you. And I actually remember sitting, and this was in a meeting called by the National Sustainable Agri Coalition. It was all four SARE regions. And the basis for the meeting was that NSAC is basically the lobbying group for sustainable ag nonprofits. And there was a feeling that we're getting from the constituents that Southern SARE was not providing enough money to nonprofits. And so we were tasked about that. But during that conversation, we even had within the context of an organization, a program that's supposed to be committed to small scale and unique forms of agriculture, people who just turned their nose up at urban agriculture told us not in the statutes, we can't even fund urban ag. So a few people had the wherewithal to go look at the actual statutes they were talking about. Not only did they not mention urban agriculture, didn't even mention agriculture. So, but through the work of the work of a lot of people like yourself, the USDA now has committed some, I ain't going to say significant funding, but they have placed its imprimatur on urban ag. And they've housed that within the National Resource and Conservation Service, which I have some issues with, and I keep a very close eye on where that is going. So, for example, they are supposed to be, they just put out for comment some, and I don't know if you saw it, but they're trying to develop what their funding prior. So this is going to be a separate program within NRCS that's going to fund urban agriculture projects, and it's going to have grant-making abilities specifically for urban ag throughout the United States.
Are you on that committee?
No one's on it, and that's what I'm getting. So the guy who's the current acting director of NIFA, Southern SARE, when I take place in our national ops meeting, I always ask him about it. So they just put out the comment period, which I think is closed now. I think it closed about a month ago. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to find out what their funding priorities should be. And they had some good ones in there, but they didn't have stuff about research around things like land issues or around zoning, which is really unique to urban agriculture. That's something that if you're going to be doing some research, you need to include in it. So I asked them, you know, well, did you guys put the committee yet? And they go, we have the committee. We want to go ahead and put the committee, but they haven't given them any money to do it yet. So I'm going to make sure that people like yourself and Bobby, once they open that up, that we really get people who have been stalwart advocates for Urban Ag to get on in, and not just pulling somebody in from NRCS who may have funded a couple of high tunnels.
Yes, oh, and the universities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because when we put together the Urban Ag Ordinance for Atlanta, we had had some fights at the beginning. It used to be technically illegal to grow food in Atlanta.
Yes.
Atlanta put together an urban zone, urban ag zoning ordinance, with at the moment was the most progressive in the nation. And I had a fight with those folks to help them understand, you cannot sit here in your ivory tower and write an urban ag ordinance and not have any farmers involved in a discussion.
Yeah.
It's not going to be relevant. So we got that part done. It's very progressive, and the zoning ordinance fundamentally said you can grow food anywhere you want to.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a, it's in an area that had previously been zoned as industrial, you got to test the soil.
Yeah.
Outside of that, you can grow anywhere. There was some contention over where you could sell. That got worked out. The compromise was brought. There's two things you don't want to see. Is sausage being made and laws being made. Because they can be very ugly. But yeah, so the answer is yes. There, all those are issues that need to be resolved. And the committee, if you have some input into that, I would love to be able to be a part of that and explain to you. You got to have some farmers, have more farmers than those university people, because they get so esoteric about nothing. I had a PhD piled higher and deeper, and those scientists know more and more about less and less. And I think sometimes it's the big.
Yeah, and when you dig down to especially local food in general, but especially in urban ag, I got a call this a couple of years ago. Congresswoman Alva Adams from up in North Carolina, one of her aides called me and said that apparently they were working on some type of legislation, and that I had been given their name. And he said, well, we want to know the role of what has been the role of the 1890s in helping to build local food systems. And you mentioned urban ag. And I said, that's easy. There hasn't been. That movement was built by nonprofits. You know, it's Fort Valley's just getting into urban agriculture. I don't even know if UGA is doing anything. They finally added a sustainable ag classes in general to their program. But it's very. But I said, no, you got to go to the nonprofits and the people who actually did this grassroots work if you want to know what's going on. You know,
so, you know, when I got here, the Master Growers, two points I want to make. First of all, the Master Growers program from the university was a chemistry class. They didn't talk about compost. They didn't talk about building soil. All they do is tell you what chemicals to put out there so you can get some kind of growth coming out the ground. That's a problem for me. The HBCU, all of these colleges are funded by the chemical companies to teach the use of the chemicals. Mm-hmm. And where I see a real problem, and it extends around the world. Africans, for example, are invited to the land-grant colleges in this country to learn agriculture, and they're taking back the American methodology back to their countries to teach the folk there. So it's a perpetuation of the American agricultural system, which is broken. It doesn't work. It's been proven all over the world that it doesn't work. The Europeans don't want American food because it's GMOs. Okay? Mm-hmm. And even cotton now is GMO. It's hard to find on a huge scale clean food, clean products. And I think that's one of the fundamental tenets of the work that I have been doing. We need to go take a step back, not trying to. I have these young people calling me up with all they're learning all this technology, wondering how to apply it to urban agriculture. I said, we need to throw all that stuff away and go back to pre-industrial regenerative agriculture. Just emulate nature. Nature does, we're lucky to live where we do because we got all these trees around here. I don't see anybody doing soil tests, putting any chemicals out there. I remember some of the classes, folks said, well, we want to do a soil test and send this to your university. I said, now you get it back. They're going to tell you what chemicals to put in to get you. And so basically, whatever they say, you're not going to do, and what we have proven to them just add compost and you'll be in good shape. That's going to take care of all the problems. That's what happens in the woods. The trees fall down, build the compost out there. So you can do the test if you want to. And the joke on that, brother, they would come back with those soil tests and our results were off the chart. In terms of organic levels, they're saying, up to 2% is good. And we had 8-9% of organic material. Mm-hmm. So all the elements that you need to have in there to grow, we were off the charts. So that proved to a lot of these young folks that our methodologies were fundamentally correct.
Yeah. And the time we have left, there's a couple of things I wanted to really touch on with you about. One is that, you know, I work with Jamila Norman and Cece. Oh God, Cece's last name escapes me right now. But they were Patchwork City Farms.
Yes, sir.
And I worked with them on getting a lease down at Brown Middle School.
We were both dancing around. I was dancing around there too.
Yeah. And one of the things that I sometimes get worried about as Black people take control of their communities and add stuff, especially in urban areas, add stuff like urban ag and local farmers markets, if they're sowing the seeds to their own destruction, if they're raising the values, because once again, I don't know how much land the folks actually own, and are they just heightening the visibility for gentrification to occur and then push people out? So I like to, you've been a much longer observer of the Atlanta scene than I have, but is that a real problem or?
Well, over where Truly Living Well is now in Collistown, there was literally a house across the street from the farm site. And I suggested to my board, let's buy it and make that the office. Mm-hmm. They said, no, we'd outgrow it real quick. So let's wait and get a better office building. I could have bought that house for $15,000. Mm. And it's been turned over a couple of times. And last time it was close to $300,000 that so forth. When I saw all the white people moving into the neighborhood, there's a Montessori school down the corner. You go out and look in the yard and nothing but white children there. So yes, gentrification is a problem. I put it in historical context that during the last recession, we started to live well in the second worst depression recession this country's ever had. So to be able to raise the money and make that thing happen is God's grace. But how over the course of time, poor people were chased out of the city. As I said, we built the largest farm twice. Both of them are on housing projects that were destroyed where Black people used to live, and we put the food in there. So gentrification is a concern. One of the things that I've been hearing over here, there's more and more conversation. I don't see as much implementation by these builders for green space. Mm-hmm. And what I contend is that if you're going to put a tree in, you can put a fruit tree, right? Historically, folks would say, well, we put a fruit tree, the fruit falls on the ground and gets, it was just a more sanitation problems having to pick it all up. But we got to eat. You're going to need the food. So it finally got Michael Haneke to agree that parks can have fruit trees, which makes sense. If someone has a piece of land, first thing I tell them, how much land you got, first thing you should do is put in fruit trees, because an apple tree will give you fruit for 100 years. And you don't, particularly if you don't know anything about agriculture, just grow and you want to get started, just take a small corner of your farm and get started and master that, but put fruit trees on a large portion of it. Because that'll provide income for your children, your grandchildren, taking that long view. So back to gentrification is a problem. There's no doubt about it. We have to find ways to keep more Black people in the cities, but it's difficult. You drive around Atlanta today, everywhere you go, they're building. Now, here's what I find is a joke. These last 4 months since we were in New Orleans, look how many people are now working at home. This means all that office space, there's going to be a collapse in that market because they're building office space that people are not going to use, and office space that they are using is empty of people, so it's just a waste of money.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that because I heard recently on the news that in New York City, the financial sector They're just saying, hey, you know what this showed us? We're going to keep at least 25 to 30% of our workers continuing to work at home.
That's right.
So what's going to happen to that space, you know?
That's my point.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about your struggles about running an actual nonprofit, just in general, and especially one that was dealing with urban ag, and what some of the challenges were?
Money.
Yep.
Money.
Mm-hmm.
And money. Mm-hmm. After that, we can talk about some of the other thing. For me, I'm going to tell you a little story. When I was in Nigeria, we were just building that company. I had a young lady to come in. She must have been 25 years old. And she starts asking about retirement and what all the benefits she's going to get from working with a brand new green field and company. I said, let me explain something to you. And I do a triangle for her. I said, I'm here and you come in, you're going to be on the bottom of this triangle. So the question is, will you be able to maintain your position as the company grows underneath you? Mm-hmm. Or are you going to stay on the bottom as it grows?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Focus, the attention was on the wrong thing. One of the manifestations of that happened with Truly Living Well is as Truly Living Well grew, I spent less time growing food, which is what I love to do, and more of it was spent on administration. That was very frustrating to me. The standards of excellence that I have always tried to demonstrate and required from the people I work with was not really understood. There's a different, you know, and I guess every generation says this. The work ethic that I bring to situations is different than what some of these young people have. They walk in the door looking at their watch. What time is my break? What time can I go home? And farming is a can't see to can't see activity. You need to understand that, you know, in the wintertime when the days are short, you get a little bit more time off because the ground is resting and so can you rest. But spring and summer, no, man, you're busy. And that folk are trying to run out. So I had a problem with work ethic, mm-hmm. trying to get greater productivity out of and greater attention to the details. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm in love with my work. And one word that I don't use very often is expectation, because expectation is an imposition of my values on you. Okay. And I anticipate that you're going to give me good quality work. But if I expect it of you, I ain't running. I'll get frustrated and mm-hmm. stressful because not necessarily going to get that. Does that make any sense to you, what I'm saying?
Yeah, it does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. But some of that just gets lost in translation. You see, when you work with folk, your question was, what are some of the problems that I had and the stressful problem? Then where are you going to get the money from? When we first started, I would go to commercial banks and they say, well, who else is doing what you're doing? I said, we're the pioneers. I said, well, no. If you want to build a McDonald's or a Wendy's, I can help you. But Urban Ag, nah, they didn't get it. Trying to get money is because it takes that to do anything.
Yeah. Did you, I'm sure you read that open letter that was put out by regarding BIPOC and funding from primarily on the foundation side. Have you seen that? It was signed on by about 50 different.
I don't know if I did, I don't remember it.
Yeah, I got it up here. I'll read a little bit for you. Well, I'll do that, tell you a story. Last year, I was going down to spend a week in Jackson, Mississippi. I was working with, I don't know if you know Felicia Bell, Miss Felicia, little small sister. Yeah, well, she does a lot of great work with those farmers in Mississippi. And anyway, I got up and I saw on my Facebook thread, this thread was blown up about some white organization had gotten a fairly substantial grant to do some work around racial and social justice in primarily in the Jackson area, but also some surrounding areas. And it took me a minute to find out it was NCAT. You know, I do a lot of work with NCAT. So I called Felicia. She told me what the deal was. It came through the Kellogg. She actually wrote the grant and made sure that Native American and Black farmers, you know, got a large sum of the money and organizations who were working with them. So a couple weeks ago, I got a call from a woman who works with NCAT, and apparently Kellogg. So a lot of the things was you know, why are white organizations be given this money, or being given this money to do work in our communities that we can do? And I understand that totally. So apparently it's happened again, deja vu all over again. And, you know, a lot of people warned them, you know, this is the problem that you have. They're perfectly fine organizations of color who can carry out this work. Why are they engaging with white organizations to come and do, you know, come and tell you what our black farmers need? So that died down. The project got completed. But apparently, because I got a call a couple of weeks ago, Kellogg was going to put another grant out there to do farmer needs assessments. And I think this one was across the country. And some people had warned NCAT that, you know, it'd be a mistake to take that money, but I think they did. And apparently they gave out two. One was assessing the impacts of COVID-19 responses. So this was an open letter basically saying that we can do this work ourselves, some of this work that we've done without your help. And one of my frustrations, I got two frustrations to work that I do, is that a lot of our organizations of color really have issues with capacity. They have great ideas and a lot of work, but they don't have the money or the staff to do the work that's included. I don't know anything about foundation funding, so I can't really speak to that, but I know it is an ongoing problem that I heard from just my participating in the Valley Fellowship. But I will tell you that someone sits on the funding side, for example, SARE, I preached SARE out the thing, and it's very hard to get some of these nonprofits. I always say, use little money to get big money. And, you know, that's something Habesha has learned very well. But you could tell us some of the challenges that you had in raising money, and specifically as an organization that, even though you're ecumenical, your primary focus is on serving black people.
You watch the language change. I'll get to that directly with some of my experience. But to have a foundation as rich as Kellogg spend a bunch of money doing an assessment, that's, as you said, that's white folks coming from the outside, or the professors going to come in and tell you what you need. As you have stated, a lot of the organizations don't have the capacity. Let's build capacity. Give that money to them. Much of that happens in life is the bell curve. You're going to have some people that is abject failures, some people that are superlative. Most are going to be in the middle. People know what they need. You got to listen to folks. If you listen to them, they will tell you, this is what I need. And then you have to say, well, that's fine, but this is what we think you should do. No. I mean, that would be my argument. Go assess the character of the people. I got a lot of loans, not loans, grants, and a couple times some loans from funding sources based upon character. Mm-hmm. I'm selling the project, but what got the deal done was people trusted my character and that I was going to do what I said I was going to do. Mm-hmm. And I think a needs assessment is more a people. I think a people assessment is what's correct. And if people can show you what they have done, what and why, and be able to explain to you why they're doing it, give them the money. Don't try to spend it for them.
Yeah. And in fact, when I got contacted about, well, how would we work with people, I reached out to some folks. I'll never forget speaking. I said, Eric, this is the deal. I'm just trying to get your opinion on this. And I said, well, if people were coming to you, he would say, look, we need what we need to do. We need money for tractors. We need to help build an infrastructure. Just give us the money, you know, just help us fund that. Our biggest need is that we're all farmers. We need somebody to sit down and do our books for us, you know, and we need to be able to pay that person. You know, volunteers only go but so far. So in the last few minutes that we have, Rashid, I want us to, hopefully we both got some long lives left in us, for us to take a walk 10 years down in the future. Where would you like to see urban ag at 10 years?
At the forefront.
Okay.
At the forefront. It's supported by the communities. And, even cities like New York, when you've flown in to LaGuardia over New York, you see all those roofs that are empty. In those high rises, you have those big 30,000 gallon barrels because Folk think of it as a fire, the water comes up, but it doesn't. It goes down. That's how you get the pressure in the showers from the roof coming down, which means those roofs are strong enough to hold some dirt and grow some food. Mm-hmm. So even in a place like New York, I don't know. I would like to think they have some community gardens in Central Park. I don't know.
I said, I don't think they do.
they should. They really should. But cities like Atlanta, everywhere you turn, Chicago has done some nice things for a dollar. You can, if your land's been empty on your block, they'll let you have that land for a dollar to grow food. A lot of all the universities have plenty of land where they can grow some food. Yeah. When I say food, you know, herbs, fruit, everything. Just being able to grow. When I talk to groups, I tell people just grow where you are. You know, grow in your backyard, front yard, balcony, patio, kitchen window. Just grow something. Because if you whoever controls your food controls you. Mm-hmm. And I think that this pandemic has helped people to understand, whoa, I do not have any food sovereignty here. I don't have any control over my food. And that needs to happen. So I'd like to see the universities. The school, it's high schools have gardens. I mean, over here, Jackson started to have one. I guess as long as Ashley was there, they were doing. I don't know what they're doing now. But the elementary schools, work that Georgia Organics was doing that, and Captain Planet getting these gardens in schools. Those are all very important. And you know, Cisco and them people have blocked having the food come from the garden on the school side into the kitchen. Their lawyers blocked all that kind of stuff. That's absurd. So that food production has a higher priority in the lives of people. You go to the grocery store, the best place, the only place I want to see you buy food is around the periphery, where you get fresh vegetables, fruit, dairy, whatever. You know, I'm not going to argue how you handle your nutrition. That's where you're going to find the meat and poultry and, you know, all the bakery, instead of all those processed foods. So I'd like to see the non-processed foods become a greater part of foodstuffs.
Okay.
Now, when they send them the people that needed food help during this pandemic, they're getting all this processed food instead of getting the fresh food. Right? Yep. So if we've grown it, if we fill all the lots around, if we build our communities with East Atlanta Village, I mean, that was developed with the garden as a part of they built a community around a farm. Serenby had that concept. Mm-hmm. They set aside 25 acres out of that 1,000 to grow food. So this is what I would like to see. I would like to see more training, technical school training, partnerships, greater advocating for organic and agriculture training at the universities and moving that direction. So we see little bits of this. Urban agriculture is a solution, is a part of the solution to any problem you have in the metropolitan areas. One of the things that's necessary is housing. Okay. If you're going to grow food, people need a place to live. Right. So if you build a community, set aside land for the agriculture and provide a house for the people who are actually doing the work on the land. So it's organic to me is whole. That's how I like to think of that term. So community building needs to include all these elements. That health is an important part of it. We live in the richest nation in the entire history of the world. It's hard to folks to wrap their minds around, and most people don't never leave the shores of America. We got the two largest bodies of water that surround this country. And to see how the rest of the world live. It's the richest country in the entire history of the world. Yet we have people who are hungry. We have people who have no homes to live in, have no health care. Our education system is nowhere near the top. And you just go through the list of all the ills and ailments that America has that we should address. But folks are so engaged in accumulating as much wealth and shutting down all those who are beneath the 1% that's collecting all this cash. Even you just look everywhere you look, all these systems and the systems that have been designed have worked very well for the people who own and control the means of production, distribution, and exchange. It's everybody else that has the problem. So it's got to change. You know, and what we're finding is that the American technologies are being rejected around the world now. Not the technology, but some of the outcome. I named a couple earlier. The in Africa, they're rejecting the GMO seeds. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons Monsanto sold out, so they could be part of Bayer, because everybody eats Bayer aspirin. Yeah. So you think, oh, it's safe. Okay? Mm-hmm. But not knowing. I mean, did you know, about, there's a book that you hadn't read, I highly recommend it. It's called Seeds of Destruction.
That's right.
By F. William Engdahl. And it's one of the most strongest books I've ever read on seeds of destruction. The last chapter talks about the corn seed. Now, what people in the world eat corn?
As a whole? People, Native American, Indian?
Well, they already killed all Indians.
Okay.
But it's Africans and South America and Latin Americans, Hispanic mm-hmm. people, whose yeah. cultures built around corn. Mm-hmm. They got a corn seed, corn that has a spermicide in it. So that means whoever eats the seed, you can't make babies. It's all part of a eugenics problem. I think, you know, and I think a lot of the elements are maybe getting off. But those are the kind of things that concern me. Hey, okay? Making people, not allowing people to have saved seed anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Trying to bring in the GMO seeds that the Monsanto, Bayer, all of them, Sygenics, control, but I just find it so distressing, a seed, a corn seed with a spermicide. I mm-hmm. see more black folk, people yeah. of color,
mm-hmm.
die. It's, or not be born.
Mm-hmm.
So I think eugenics is eugenics is at the basis of a whole lot of the policies that we see being implemented.
Yeah. We even see it in this pandemic, you know, the agricultural workers who work in the slaughterhouses are forced back to work. And it was a picture that struck me. I think it was in Iowa. They showed a line of people clapping for the meat workers who were going back to the plants, actually being forced to go back to the plant. You know what was interesting, Rashid? They didn't show a picture of those workers. You know why? Because they were probably most likely all Hispanic, you know? And that contrast between a whole row, blocks of white people applauding people going back to work in an environment where you know people are going to get sick and die. That contrast would have been, I just think it would have been stark, to say the least. So let's end on a positive note. How do people get your book?
Oh, man. If you want a signed copy, you can go to my website. It's thenurigroup.com. There's /book. And I'll sign it for you. Send it to you. In fact, I got a bag right. Just went to the post office. They'll have their book next week.
Okay. It's a good read. I read the chapter about your journey. Having been, we need to get some money for some of you folks to do some Audible books. You know, because that's how I gather a lot of my information now. When I'm in it, well, I'm not driving as much anymore. But I think it's important too for people who don't claim they don't have the time to read, to really hear this story in your voice. So that's something, you know, I'm going to be talking to Sarah about. You know, we have people like yourself and Mama Ira Wallace with Southern Exposure Seed Company who have these great stories to tell. And you may have a book and people may get around to reading it, but it's nothing for people to pop in their things and listen to an audible book. So
yeah, I'm hearing more of that. So if you can help with that, that'd be great.
I'm going to see, you know, Southern Sarah's always looking for ways to connect more effectively, especially with communities of color. So that's a little pet project I'm trying to get done. So
thank you, brother. That would be wonderful. There's a number of folk out here that could benefit from that. Yeah. And if I can do anything to help you or your listeners, Rashid at the Nuri Group.
Okay.
And my phone number, 404-520-8331. You go to the website, it's all there.
Okay, well, I thank you for taking the time to be on this. This has truly been an honor for you to have you on for my 10th episode. And I'd like to have you on again, especially as we go through this pandemic and we see how agriculture is going to truly change.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast. Please visit our website at sustainableagwriter.com, where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. If you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Please tell your friends and colleagues about the show and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Once again, thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast, sustainable ag news and views.